Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
And I said to them, I'm going to be a party pooper tomorrow.
Okay, so, ladies and gentlemen, I would like to introduce not only a great person, but a really good friend of mine, and I'm really happy to have another Aussie on the Racket Magazine podcast, Samantha Stoser. And Sam, before you say anything, I just want people to know we're actually in Miami, and we're doing this interview here, and you're going to be playing another doubles final tomorrow. So this has been a great week for you. And also, it is your birthday today. And you are 35 years of age. So happy birthday, and thank you for joining me on the Recommend Scene podcast.
Thanks, Stubbsy.
Yeah. So, you know, a lot of people request certain people, and a lot of people requested you on this podcast. So, and I think one of the
I'm glad I can give the people what they want.
Give the people what they want, Sammy. But, you know, a lot of people, a lot of things I like to get across on the Racket Magazine podcast is people's real personalities are really who they are. And I think people would not know a lot about you because you're pretty laid back. But how did tennis come into your life, basically?
Kind of by chance. When I was, about 8 years old, a next-door neighbour gave me a racket for Christmas, and I've got an older brother who's 8 years older than me, Daniel, and fortunately for me and for my younger brother, Daniel looked after us a lot after school. Mum and Dad ran a cafe, so he'd pick us up after school on our bikes and we'd ride home, and then I got given this tennis racket and we'd go down to the park that was a few houses down, and there was five tennis courts there, and we'd just play every afternoon pretty much and wait for Mum and Dad to come home, and kind of went from there, and I eventually got a tennis lesson at Memorial Drive in Adelaide.
Yeah, where the original Brisbane tournament was played.
Yep.
Wait, did you play on grass, or were you playing on
hard courts? No, it was the hard courts there. Yeah. And
I'm a lot older than you, so.
Yeah. I had my little group lesson eventually, and then got a private lesson. I remember after the first group lesson, Mum and Dad have reminded me of this. The coach was like, oh, who belongs to this girl? And they were like, oh, no, what has she done? She's done something wrong here. She's going to get in trouble. And the coach, Bruce Wren, his name was, said, oh, she should probably get some private lessons. Huh. And Mum and Dad were like, oh, he's just trying to get more money out of us.
That's such a typical Australian thing to say.
Why would they even say that? And so, yeah, then I just got some private lessons and played fixtures on the weekends, as mm-hmm. you do. And, mm-hmm. Just kept playing it. Absolutely loved it.
Okay, so one of the things that people are obsessed when it comes to you is the biceps. So, mm-hmm. And I get asked this question all the time, you know, what the hell does she do? And I said, I think it's pretty natural. Were you always like a little bit of a rock as a kid, or did you like...
Yeah, I was always looked athletic and pretty fit, even if maybe I wasn't back in the day, but I probably was naturally like that. And both of my brothers can gain muscle super quick.
So are your biceps bigger than your brother?
No.
Really?
No.
You sure? I think you
depends
might have to
what phase they're in. My younger brother especially will go through stages of like trying to get a bit bigger, and then he'll have competitions with his mates about who can put on more weight and then lose it quicker, and which is just ridiculous. He's obviously got a very quick metabolism, so he can just choose what he wants to do for
How
certain periods.
He?
Yeah. And but yeah, they don't really go running or anything. They go out and have a hit every now and then.
They don't do what you do.
No, they certainly don't do what I do. And actually, Christmas Day, all three of us got out on the court and had a little hit together for the first time in I don't know how many years, and that was actually pretty fun.
Yeah, did you have a good laugh there?
We did.
Yeah. when you think about like growing up in Australia and all that sort of stuff, were there people that you looked up to from Australia, or you know, were you? I know who your idol is.
Mm-hmm.
You can tell us that. But did you think that it was even remotely possible that you could be really good?
Well, I mean,
like,
I
when
guess...
does that hit?
Probably like 12-ish, I would say, I was starting to think, oh, I want to be a professional tennis player. But at the age of 12, I had no idea what that meant, mm-hmm. what a life on tour was going to be, or mm-hmm. if there even was a tour, because I just would watch,
well, you're a kid
you know,
from
the
Gold
odd
Coast.
Tournament on TV, like yeah. the Aussie Open, and yeah. that was it. And yeah. Like when I was in 93, so I must have been 9. Mum and Dad flew all of us, my brothers and them, to Melbourne for the women's final mm-hmm. of the Aussie Open when we were still living in Adelaide. And I watched Monica and Steffi play, what? Who were my two favourites. Uh-huh. And I wore my outfit to the match. I had Steffi's shirt. I probably took my racket too, who knows. And, yeah, I remember being there and watching that final. And
so Steffi was your idol.
Yeah, but I loved Monica as yeah, well, yeah. both of them. Yeah. And, that was just the best day ever. And we had this like weekend in Melbourne, just like our family, and that was it. And then we flew home and then that was it. So yeah. even from a really young age, like that's what I kind of looked at and thought, oh, that'd be pretty cool. And then as you get older and you go to junior tournaments yeah. and you start playing more, everything just kind of goes the way, you don't know any other way that it should be, but yeah. everything kind of fell into place for me. So I guess I was fortunate that one, I kept playing because a lot of my peers in my age group all stopped after juniors or very soon after.
Why is that, you think? It's just...
I think sometimes people just don't enjoy the lifestyle. Maybe things get a bit harder. And I mean, there were certainly times through junior trips, like my first junior trip to Europe, I was 15 in the 18s team. Mm-hmm. I was way out of my depth. Mm-hmm. I'd never been on a clay court before, and the first 5 weeks were on clay.
How funny is that?
And then the next 5 weeks were on grass. And I did not win a match. I didn't win a set on the clay. I didn't win a match until Junior Wimbledon. And
it's
it
kind
was
of funny. I laugh about that now in my head mentally, because I think you would run from a grass court and you were so happy on a clay court.
Totally, but I didn't know what I was doing.
Yeah, yeah,
and
yeah.
I was so young.
Yeah, yeah.
But I just was in the in that team in the upper age group, and that was really hard. I remember calling home probably 2-3 times a day in tears. I want to come home, and got really homesick and just wasn't enjoying it. Mm-hmm. And but stuck it out. I did the whole 10 week, like 10 week trip as
a long time.
15,
as
that's
a 15
pretty
year.
Hard.
Yeah.
But I actually think looking back now, it maybe wasn't as bad as what it felt like at the time.
Yeah.
But it also probably taught me a lot about resilience and sticking it out, and mm-hmm. probably was obviously a really good thing for my career. And then we did that. I did that another year after. And did a bit better, but I didn't win a match at Roland Garros for 5 years through juniors or like qualifying anything.
Oh my god! Well,
so,
we'll get
yeah.
to Roland Garros.
But
okay,
now when I look back, I'm like, geez, wow, what a turnaround! But I just had never seen a clay court before.
Yeah, so we'll get to that part of your career and that part of your life in a second, but. One of the things that that I remember, because obviously I know you pretty well, was the first time I saw you play Fed Cup. And I hadn't really seen... I don't know if I'd seen you play very much at all, if anything, and you were on the team with
mm-hmm.
me. And you played your first singles match. And I had a little... I went to your room
mm-hmm.
the night before your first round. Because I remember when I first played my first Fed Cup match in singles, I remember feeling like I had I was having an out-of-body experience, because
mm-hmm.
it's such a different thing to play for your country. And I remember thought, you know, I don't want to tell Sam how to play, but I thought I might want to give you a little bit of a heads up on how you're going to feel when you walk on the court. And I said, you know, this is a very different circumstance when you play for your country, and you're going to feel like you're a little bit not yourself. I don't know if it was true or not, but one of the things I remember was the first 3 to 4 games, I thought, holy shit, this girl is so good. You were so composed.
Mm-hmm.
You probably didn't feel it.
Yeah.
You were probably shitting yourself. But I felt like me watching you, I thought, oh, this kid's going to be good one day.
Yeah.
Really good. Because of the way you handled that moment. Do you remember that moment?
Yeah, yeah. I played Zuluaga.
There you go.
We were playing Columbia at Wollongong.
Yeah, and how did you feel? How was that experience?
I was definitely nerve-wracking.
You lost. But
yeah, I lost 6-4 in the third, but the way I played and my composure and what I did, I think that, I mean, I remember it. So it was obviously an important time now looking back in my career that, oh, even in these big moments, I've got what it takes to handle it. And obviously sometimes you handle it better than others, but in a moment like that, playing for your country and you've got your team on the side, and I mean, all of you, you, Pratty and Alicia, were all far more experienced than I was, and I get the chance to play.
Yeah.
There's a bit of pressure there as well to, you know, come up with the goods, I guess, or not, you know, prove your worth in the team. So,
I think you did. I think
that was great, because I do remember that, and it was an amazing experience, and I've obviously played many Fed Cups since then, and yeah, been able to handle that really well.
Yeah, you are definitely one of the best Fed Cup players I've been around and seen play, because you were always great under pressure, and it started at a very young age, which made me think you can handle the big time. So cut to, you know, you're sort of dealing with some injuries then, right, in your early 20s and trying to make your way onto the tour. What was the change in particular when you started thinking that you should be better than what your results were showing? Like, what was a period of time where you thought, all right, I should be much better than I am? And I don't want to also forget that you'd also had great success in doubles at that point with Lisa Raymond, winning a couple of Grand Slams. Or was it three with Lisa? Was it two with Lisa?
Two finals.
Two finals, one with Match Point, which you made up for recently. Yeah. But so how much did that help you, that experience of being around Lisa and winning Slams? And then how did that translate into singles?
Well, I mean, playing with Lisa was massive, because I was young when she asked me to play, and
yeah, I think she dumped me for you.
Yeah,
actually.
She did.
And bit of a sore subject, but we won't get it.
But I thought, geez, wow, what a privilege to play with someone like that.
And yeah, she's dumped Renee for me. I better not screw this up.
I was like, sorry, Stubbsy, but I'm taking this. And I had to stop playing with my partner too, because I was playing with a really good friend of Breanne Stewart, and we just had our best result. We made semis at Wimbledon, and we'd been doing pretty, we won Sydney that year, and we'd been doing pretty well, and we were both at career high rankings in the top 20.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, this, you know, legend of the game asked me to play, and I was like, oh, what do I do? Do I go there because I think what a
opportunity,
or do I keep playing my friend and we're doing really well and see where that goes? And that was a really hard choice and decision to have to make. And I end up playing with Lisa, and Breanne was definitely a little bit upset about it at the time.
Yeah, so was I.
Fair enough. And I totally get it.
Oh, we're all over
but
it.
But we've all patched it up, and we're still great friends
with
Breanne.
We have drinks together now.
The first three, four tournaments Lisa and I played, we lost first round, and I felt lots of pressure playing with her, and, you know, am I
good enough
to keep playing with her? And I remember we were in San Diego, we'd played, we'd lost leading into the US Open, and she broached the subject of stopping playing with me.
I remember
sitting on a little grass, little mound.
In San Diego?
Yeah, I'm sure it was in
San
Diego.
Bloody hell, she gave you one tournament to prove yourself? Two.
No, we played
Stanford,
two or three.
And San Diego.
And I was like, no, let's just stick it out. We'll go a little bit
longer. I
actually
think I won those tournaments.
You probably. I was like, no, let's just go a little bit longer. Let's just see how we go. And thank God, because then we played the US Open and we won it. And then it was like,
good decision.
Where did that come from? And we were playing Panetta and Dementieva in the final. And I was as nervous as what you could ever imagine. But I do remember we won or whatever it was. We were going into the third set. And I remember sitting on that changeover. And I said to Lisa, it's all right, I've got it now. I'm going to start playing better. I'm not going to be as nervous now. I'm going to play better.
Did you lose the second set? Or did you win
We must have lost the second set. I'm thinking we won the first and then maybe got kind of close.
Yeah,
and
you got a bit tight.
A little bit nervous or whatever. And I was like, no, I'm going to be good now. And then we won the third set. It was like, oh my God, I've just won a Grand Slam. Yeah. I'd won mixed at Aussie Open that year.
Yeah.
So I'd kind of had a bit of an experience like that. But this was, I mean, even bigger, and you're away and in, you know, Arthur Ashe. And, so that moment actually was big for me, even playing, who knows, maybe years later, playing the singles final there, because I'd been in a big occasion and
why
I
was
pretty young.
Why was it so big, that moment? Were you,
I think, because
distinctly remember?
Well, it was the biggest thing I'd ever won, obviously, and you're on the biggest stage, and again, I'm playing with someone who I
admired and respected.
Tons of respect for and admired and wanted, again, to not let the team down because if we were going to lose, it was going to be on me.
Mm.
And I didn't want that to be the case. And I really stepped up in that moment. And we both played great. And I remember it. And it was incredible. So we didn't start out too well. But then from that tournament, I think then we won like our next three or four events beat you in a couple of those.
I got you once.
And then we had a great
career together.
And then I got Lyme disease.
Yeah, hold on. So I want to tell this story because it's kind of funny, but not funny. It's actually kind of terrible, but it's a little bit funny at the start. So I'm playing against you at Wimbledon, and, you know, we're great mates and obviously very good friends with Lisa, and we beat you in Eastbourne the week before, Cara and I, Cara Black. Oh, no, it was Kvetta Peshnik at that time. And I see you in the locker room at Wimbledon, and I go to give you, I don't know, a handshake or something. And then I notice that you had this lump on your neck. And I remember thinking, what the hell is that? And you go, I know, right? What is it? And I'm seeing the doctor, and I don't know what's going on. And then I ended up playing you, I think, the next day.
We played in the third round, I think.
Yeah, I don't know. It was the third or fourth round. And I went, you beat us, and I went to shake your hand. And then I sort of looked at you and went, I don't know if I want to touch you. Because you were covered in this rash and everything. It was so weird. And you were kind of freaking out a little bit, which was understandable.
Yeah.
And then cut two, so that's Wimbledon July. And then US Open rolls around, and
I'd been home after Wimbledon, and I didn't play until US Open because I went home and tried to work out
what was wrong
with me, because I'd had a bunch of different tests done at Wimbledon. Nobody could work it out, but I was getting all these different symptoms and things happening, and
injuries.
It just wasn't good.
Yeah.
And so I went home, and they told the doctors then thought I had rubella, and then I just thought, oh, okay, well, that's happened. That's what it is.
And then you were living in Florida at the time, so going home was not normal for you.
No, I went back to Australia. Yeah. But then I thought, okay, well, stuff it. I'll go play US Open, even though I'm underprepared, and I just need to get fit again. I've lost all my conditioning, that's what I'll go do.
It doesn't take long to do that.
No. And I played singles there against Elise Cornet, and I remember after three games I had no chance of winning the match. I was done. I was exhausted, couldn't move, couldn't do anything. Lost that, and then stayed around and was training with my coach, and he was like, we just got to get fit again, blah blah blah. And so we'd practice a little bit and then like go on the bike, try and run, did that for like, I don't know, a week or so, still at the courts, and then we went out.
So you lost the doubles with Lisa. And then I was out of the doubles at that time, and we hit the town in New York City, because it's normal after a Grand Slam, you go out, have a couple of drinks with your friends, but after the US Open, it tends to be maybe sometimes a bit bigger because it's the last Grand Slam.
It's been a long year.
It's been a long year. So we hit the town, we go out, I was at the bar, and we were ordering a lot of drinks, we got a little drunk, you know, being honest, and we leave the bar, and you kept complaining the whole night, oh, my rib, and I was like, ah, you're fine, Sam, you just got a rib out or something.
My chest was a bit
sore.
Yeah,
chest was sore, you're all, you know, all over the shop, and I, of course, thought I was a, you know, physio that night.
Or a doctor,
whatever. You know, I didn't even stay in a Holiday Inn. Anyway, I decided I'm going to give you a bit of a back crack, right, remember, and I've got heels on, and you're like, you know, again, cobblestone streets in New York. Anyway, as we go back from me trying to crack your back, you end up falling down, and I'm attached to you, if you can remember, everybody time, because you can't imagine.
We're standing back to back with our arms
interlocked, and you go stand back, which normally you let go of my arms, but you didn't let go of my arms, you just kept going flat down, and you went flat down on your face, and I remember thinking, oh my God, I think you've just broken your nose, you're going to have no teeth. I rolled off your back, and I looked at you, and you looked at me, and you go, did I hurt my chin? And meanwhile, you've got this big gash out of your chin, which I thought was actually pretty good. I thought your teeth were all going to be gone. So then you're not feeling good all of a sudden. You went to the ER by yourself,
and they
didn't
really want to look at us because they thought we were just drunk. And so we left and then woke up the physio and then explained to her. And I think she just thought we were all a bit silly.
Yeah.
And anyway, went back to hospital. And then they did a couple of tests and couldn't really come up with anything. So we left, went back to the hotel, and ended up going to somewhere else later.
Yeah, it was like 3 days in the hospital, and ended up not knowing what was wrong with you.
And I stayed in New York for another couple of days, And
then you flew down to Tampa.
Flew to Tampa, and on that flight started getting the worst headache I could remember ever having.
Yeah.
And got home, and then that night just kept getting worse and worse and worse.
No, actually, I picked you up from the airport, and we took you to... You came home to my place in Tampa and had dinner at my place, and mm-hmm. you kept complaining about your head, and I was yeah. like, take a couple of Advil.
Yeah.
You know? And then... all of a sudden at 6 a.m. in the morning, you called me, which was very inconvenient at 6 a.m. and I thought, why the hell is Sam calling me at 6 a.m? Anyway, you said to me, your words exact were, Stubbsy, my head, I feel like it's going to explode. You have to take me to the ER. Mm. And I thought, bloody hell, it must be bad, because you're as tough as anyone I've ever been around as far as injuries are concerned. So we whip you off to the ER, and the guy says, oh, nah, it's nothing. You've just got a sinus infection or something. And I said mm. to him, are you sure? Because I was getting advice from some doctors as well and mm-hmm. friends of mine and physios, and saying, you should see if she's got viral meningitis. I don't even know who brought that up.
Mm.
And anyway, they ended up giving you drugs. You went back to my place.
Your place.
And you took the drugs, and every time you took a drug, you were just throwing up.
Yeah.
And then,
because then I was allergic to that, as it turns out.
Oh, I didn't know that. I thought, oh, that's hilarious.
I didn't know that at the time, though.
So then, cut to, I ended up having to take you to another hospital about 10 o'clock at night. Mm. And at about, I remember at 12:30 at night, sitting there, and they said, we're going to have to do a spinal tap. And
yeah.
I thought, oh, my God. And they did. And then they said, they came back and said, you've got viral meningitis. And
yeah.
that's when I said, okay, mate, I'm going home.
Yeah.
I left you in the hospital by yourself, you poor thing.
You told me you were going to be there no matter what. And then they told me that. And you're like, okay, see you later.
No, well, what I did was I went back and got your toothbrush
no,
and a change of clothes and came back the
and
next
came
morning.
And came visited me
yeah,
the next
yeah,
day
yeah,
and
then
everything.
Cooked for you for a week. And anyway, but it was an incredible period of time for you because how scared were you that you're this was really bad?
Well, yeah, because I'd never... had that, or obviously I didn't know what that kind of meant and how long it was going to take to recover, and all that. Like, I'm in Florida and, you know, I'm there by myself. Thankfully you're only a couple of minute drive away, but, you know, it's still
scary.
Yeah, it's absolutely scary. And I didn't walk out of my front door for 8 days, I remember.
Yeah.
Because I just couldn't sit upright for yeah. more than like a couple of minutes, and getting up and thinking, okay, I'm gonna go have a shower now, was just like a rush to, oh, I'm going to get up, get my clothes, and I'm going to lay back down again before the headache starts. And then I quickly have a shower and lay back down.
Mm.
And then my dad ended up coming over as quickly as he could to be with me. And then I went and saw some other... Once I got over that, mm-hmm. then went and saw infectious disease doctors, and took them a couple of weeks to, I guess, diagnose me with
Lyme disease.
And then they pieced everything together, did a whole bunch of tests, and they were like, yeah, well, viral meningitis is kind of going through the phases and the stages of Lyme disease. So
what did they tell you when you got Lyme disease, how that was going to affect you for the rest of your life?
Well, they said you got to be super careful when you do recover, because it can, you can easily relapse and it can come back if you're not
mm-hmm.
smart about what you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, probably going to be more prone to
injuries.
Arthritis and
oh.
possibly injury. So, I mean, doing what we do, you're going to be prone to that
anyway.
And then
I can
you put that on
to
top,
that.
It's probably not ideal. And yeah, just being really run down for a long time. And I mean, as it turns out, I didn't play for 10 months. It was 10 months till my next event. And
did it worry you or scare you? Because also, you know, we sort of have a little thing in Australia with someone like Alicia Molik, who was top 10 in the world. And, you know, I really felt like Alicia could win a Grand Slam. She had the game to do it. She was playing so well. And she got the middle ear infection, which really derailed her career. Did you feel like, I mean, I know you weren't really specifically thinking about someone like Alicia, but were you thinking like, shit, is this going to happen to me as well? Like, and you'd gone through a lot of injuries, shoulder problems.
Yeah, I mean, I think because, maybe because I had, didn't know, I'd never heard of it before.
Lyme's
I got
disease.
It. Yeah. So I think maybe not knowing anything until then, I got diagnosed with it, and then you start reading about it and you learn more. I mean, now I know lots about it, but I think that maybe kind of helped, because it was like...
Didn't freak you out.
Yeah,
much.
Exactly.
Yeah. You were just like, oh, I feel better, I'm good, let's go.
Naivety kind of probably helped with all that.
Yeah.
And but I know in myself, I really followed what the doctors, what everyone, the physios and everyone... prescribed me to do when I could start doing things again. I didn't do 1 minute more than what they said, because they drummed it into me, especially the doctor.
That's a good lesson for people.
Yeah, about what you can and cannot do and how slow I had to come back. And I'm talking starting with a 20-minute walk trying to keep my heart rate under 120.
Uh-huh.
And that was so hard to stay at a slow pace to keep under 120.
Yeah.
I mean, go for a walk now and it would probably not even be 80. So
Because you were so unfit.
Yeah, a massive difference. But I stuck to it like you would not believe. And then...
Is that your nature anyway?
I'm pretty good at following directions.
There you go.
Yeah, so like...
It's a good lesson for people though at home or tennis players or juniors who I feel go and start too early.
Mm-hmm.
You know, interestingly, here playing right now in front of us are the Bryan brothers, you know, and Bob has said that, you know, he probably came back a little bit early with the hip injury, but sometimes, you know, with injuries, it's a little bit different because you have to trust the body again. And he's like, look, he's a bloody $6 million man with a fake hip. So it's a little different. But I feel that tennis players often try go too early.
For sure, 100%.
So it's a good lesson.
Yeah, but I think also with an illness too, it's almost a bit more scary than
an injury.
And I mean, when I first played, I remember flying back to the States for my first event and I went nearly a week early.
Yeah.
And I would never go a week. I might go 3-4 days early, but I went even earlier to give myself time to acclimatise, get over the jet lag first, slowly ease into it.
Did it help you mentally after that injury? Like, because at that point you were a very good singles player,
mm-hmm.
top 30, I believe.
Yeah.
Top 30, obviously doing very well in doubles. Did it mentally help you to go, all right, this is... I had my career almost taken away from me. Really taken away from me.
Yeah.
Did it make you appreciate it more and make you... You always worked hard, but make you work even harder and mentally be better? Because that was sort of the problem, was you didn't really trust you. I don't think you thought... I think you lacked the self-belief when it really came down to it.
Yeah, probably. And I think having that happen, again, I was quite young in your career to think, oh, geez, is this all going to be finished and what am I going to do? Because this is all I'd ever dreamt about doing.
Well, we'll get to that later.
But, I think it really did make me stop and be like, okay, am I doing everything I possibly can? Not that I was taking shortcuts, but there's always just that little bit more, I probably could, or making the right decision to go play a different schedule or something like that. And, I mean, unfortunately for Lisa and myself, she kind of wore the brunt of that, because then I thought, I'm doing great, but I really think I can be a better singles player.
So when did that change for you? Like, when did the moment come where the singles really, you went, wow, I really can, I could be good and maybe win a slam?
Well, when I first started again, because that was the absolute priority, was to get my singles career on track and doubles. Because I never set out to be a great doubles player.
No.
It just happened. Mm. And I love it and I wouldn't change it for anything. But having to start again, I was like, no, I need to almost kind of put...
I can play doubles later in my career.
Put all my eggs in one basket and start really doing everything I can for singles. And that's what I did. Because I thought I could be better than 30 in the world, which is what I was kind of hovering around for a while. And so that was kind of what helped change that. So even though it was a complete disaster and something I'd never want to go through, if I... didn't, I don't know, maybe I wouldn't have made that decision when I did, and then who knows what could have happened.
So take me through those French Open runs in particular, like the first run. You had a great start that year, remember, because ironically we were playing doubles at that period of time, because you were like, I can still play a little bit of doubles here and there, and you were maybe being a token helping me out, but you made the semis of Miami, the tournament we're at right now, which was a great win, and you beat Dinara Safin. I remember that, she was ranked number one in the world at the time.
Yeah.
And semi-finals of Miami is a big tournament, and then the run to the semis of the French that year. And I think that's when things started changing with you, like, shit, like, I can really do damage in these big tournaments.
Yeah, that tournament in the French, that was 2009.
Yeah.
That was kind of like, okay, yeah, I can play with the best, and I know I can beat them too.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hold up.
What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
I spoke to you the day after the final, the women's final that year, and it was Dinara Safin and Kuznetsova.
Yeah.
You lost to Kuznetsova in three. Yeah. And I remember we were texting back and forth, and you said to me, because we were sharing an apartment as well during the French, and you said to me, I feel worse today after that final than I did when I lost.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, yeah, don't ever let it happen again. Because I think that you didn't think that you were worthy enough to win a slam.
Or, yeah, probably.
Or maybe good enough, and you were, and I don't think you ever lost to Kuznetsova after that. If I'm
I did later, years later, but
what, not for a while.
Yeah, but I do remember for her to break serve in the third set on me, she hit an amazing backhand down the line winner off one of my kickers out wide, and she broke me, I think, to go up 3-1, and I end up losing at 6-3, and I don't feel like I did anything probably wrong looking back, but maybe there was just that little bit of lack of belief, which then didn't obviously put you in the point quite enough.
Yeah.
I didn't play stupid or bad, but it was just a little bit lacking because maybe I didn't believe it.
Mentally, the difference between you and Kuznetsova at that stage were that you subconsciously didn't think you were good enough to win a slam, and she knew she was.
Yeah, well, and she'd done it once before.
Exactly, and that was the difference, I think, that won her that match in particular. So then cut to the next year, you played a phenomenal French Open. You beat, believe it or not, Serena, Hennin, and Yankovic, which to people at home at that time of their careers was phenomenal to beat those three. And then you play Schiavone in the final, who you'd beaten in the first round of the French the year before. Believe it or not. And you pretty much schooled Schiavone. But what did you learn from that loss that then translated to the US Open victory?
Well, it took me probably the best part of a year to get over that match, almost. I mean, I could not watch it. I never watched it, and then I don't think it was until the French Open the next year I was sitting in the cafe like before the tournament, and they just had it on replay, and I'm kind of, no matter where I looked, it was on all the TVs, so I was forced to see it, and it was brutal because I was the favourite going into that match with my ranking, who I'd beaten all the rounds before.
So many times prior.
And unfortunately, she
played great.
She played amazing, and she played much better than what she had against me. She obviously thought going into the match, if I don't do something different and I don't take these risks, I'm not going to win.
And she did.
She did. And on that day, in the biggest moment, she stepped up and she executed it and she deserved to win.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas I was still probably a little bit scared. And then she was playing really well. And
super
I was like,
aggressive too.
Yeah, a bit, oh,
what's
happening here? Yeah. What am I doing? Where do I go?
Yeah.
And it was kind of one of those matches. So, again, once I could watch it and see what actually happened and see it for what it was, not what I felt it was, it allowed me to move on from that and probably think, all right, I'm not going to let that happen again.
So the US Open rolls around. You'd beaten Serena a couple of times.
Mm-hmm.
You almost beat her also in Sydney. So you technically at that point you'd had two wins against her,
I believe.
And
one match point
almost
in another.
Win in Sydney. Why was it about going into that match that you really believed that you could win? That helped you so much because, you know, look, Serena played a really late night match two nights before. You'd played one really great tennis going into the final.
My schedule was screwed during that whole tournament as well. So there was a whole heap of stuff going on in the background that nobody at home on TV would ever... Well, there was rain delays, back-to-back matches. I had my... the match I played with, I think it was Kirilenko. We were meant to be on centre court,
I think. Got moved to grandstand.
Got moved to grandstand. Last minute, but had to then be held for like another hour, and then it was all about, I think Andy Roddick was playing maybe, and they were like, no, that's going to go on, and then we're not going to put you on there. It was just a whole bunch of stuff, and rain delays and whatever.
So it was as difficult for you?
It was hard. So we played on grandstand a little bit earlier in the afternoon, and going into Serena's match starting, they told us that there was going to be a bunch of fireworks happening, and they're like, no, it's not going to disrupt your match. all of a sudden there's fireworks going off and all this stuff. Anyway, so I finished, beat Kerber. Yes, Serena finished late, but for whatever reason, I had no doubt in my mind that I could win that match the following day. And I remember getting out of the van, myself and all the, my team that were there, and we rocked up to our hotel and we were getting out and we got all our stuff out of the back and we were all kind of standing there deciding, all right, dinner, what are we doing for the rest of the night? Like, you're playing a final tomorrow, what are we doing? And I turned and I said to them, I'm going to be a party pooper tomorrow. And I don't know, I would never normally outwardly say something like that to be confident.
Meaning what? Oh, you're going to be you were going to be a party pooper for
because,
Serena.
Yeah, because, I mean, she's American, playing US Open. It was kind of this dream comeback of hers.
Yeah.
It was the 10th anniversary of 9/11. Like, it was a massive day.
Yeah.
And I was not expected. Like, it was all about Serena. It was all about Serena to win the event. And even watching on TV the whole tournament, every day you'd watch it, it was all about nobody else was going to win the tournament except Serena.
Yeah, yeah.
And I just said, I'm going to be a party pooper tomorrow.
Wow.
And I went to bed and obviously played great.
Yeah,
but
played great.
As soon as I was in the final, I just really believed I could win.
Okay, so take us through that match because, you know, obviously everybody remembers the situation with Naomi and Serena at the US Open last year. But you were, well, actually.
No.
Kim, look, Serena's had her issues at the US Open. And listen, I'm friends with Serena. I mean, I love her, and I love her crazy. But Kim had the situation, and then you also had a situation where the umpire called hindrance.
Yes.
Take me through that exact moment.
Oh, yeah. So we played the point, and I'd heard her yell and whatever. Yeah. She said, come on.
And
because she hit a winner, and I had no chance of getting it. And then the umpire called hindrance and gave me the point.
Yeah.
And I was a bit, in all honesty, I was a bit confused about what was going on. And that was a game point then. So we were changing ends.
Yeah.
But I was like, am I getting the point? Is that the rule? I'm not really sure. And then I remember looking up to my box and my manager was standing up and he's like, change ends. And like motioning change ends. And I was like, I don't know what to do. And so I walked to the chair and went, but sat down, and then we all know what happened. And I actually couldn't hear anything she was saying because it was so loud in there, which is probably a good thing. So I just sat there and focused, and then won that first set. And I remember
the crowd must have been. I mean, my experience last year was 5 times worse than you. Maybe twice as bad as you, but it was pretty bad.
Yeah, no.
Did you feel like digging a hole?
The thing was, because, I mean, they were obviously pro Serena, which was totally expected and absolutely fine by me, but because I was playing well, I hadn't given her really a chance to get into the match. So for the crowd to want someone to win, there wasn't a lot going on for them to keep cheering and be super enthused about what was going on up until that point. And then when that happened, she obviously got angry, and then the crowd got behind her. And I don't think they weren't against me, but they wanted to see this contest.
And the worst part about it is you didn't have your glasses on, so you could hide behind them because it was nighttime match.
It was just a massive turnaround. And then after I won that first set, if a microphone was anywhere near me, it would have picked up my heartbeat because it was pumping out of my chest because I was like, oh my god, I'm a set up on Serena in the final of the US Open.
And all these people
don't want me to win. And
what do you tell yourself?
What
do you tell yourself to calm down? What did you tell yourself, I guess?
I just went to thinking about what I had to do to play the point. So it went total
tactical
mode. That was it.
So you get to match point and you've got...
Well, actually, firstly, let me say, this is actually kind of... Yeah, I don't know if I've really told this story much, but so then when the crowd started going against me, there was a really important couple of games, and she almost started running away with the second set early on.
Mm-hmm.
And then we had this point, and we were both at the net, reflex volleys. There was three or four volleys back and forth, and I hit a backhand cross-court volley winner past her. as I was turning around to go back to the baseline, I saw out the corner of my eye her clap the point on her racket.
Mm.
And for some reason, that settled me.
Oh, that's so... This is why we love the podcast.
Yeah.
Because that is an amazing thing to know.
I saw that and I thought, I'm all right. She's not pissed at me. I don't know why that would even matter.
Well, but that was kind of what that tells. That tells you a lot about the respect level that every single player, including you, who had beaten her twice, has for her.
Yeah.
That you saw out of the corner of your eye her going, okay, she clapped that. Wow. Okay, she's not mad at me. Okay, relax.
Yeah, I'm
okay now. And you didn't care what the crowd thought.
No.
You actually cared about what she thought.
Yeah.
That's so interesting.
So then turned around, played the next point, held, broke, whatever was going on. And
the heart rate went from 180 to 120.
To maybe a bit normal again. Yeah. And then I won the set 6-3 and the match was over.
But wait, so match point, when you get match point and she misses that first serve.
Yeah.
I know the shot you hit, obviously.
She'd had a match point before and we'd had a longer rally and she hit a smash for a winner. And then we played juice point. I won that.
And you get that forehand and what do you tell yourself? And what did you tell yourself after it was over?
Well, when she missed that first serve, I was like, okay, this is good. I knew that I was going to hit a forehand on the return. There was no chance I wasn't going to hit a forehand and there was no chance it wasn't going to go off. Because I'd hit a ton of winners.
Inside out. Yeah.
I'd hit a ton of winners that way and I was just hitting it great. And so it was just...
Were you shaking?
Oh, probably.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I definitely was the first match point. And probably the second one I was a little bit better, but definitely had the jelly legs.
I loved your reaction. Yeah. It was just a reaction of, I can't believe this just fucking happened.
Yeah. Oh, it was incredible.
Yeah.
And going back, and then I went up into the box and did all that, but I kind of, it felt so surreal and almost like out of body.
Yeah.
I wish I could almost go back into that and really experience it almost kind of not enjoy it more but just almost not
take
it,
it
felt
all
like
in.
More yeah
take it all
because
in.
It was just so
crazy.
Wow.
And also with what happened with the crowd and everything, you're just like, oh my god, this is just... Did you party that night?
Yeah, but well, we found, well, oh god, nobody had organized anything, of course, because it was, I mean, it was all just
even though
rush.
You said you're going to be a party pooper.
Well, yeah, exactly. So we actually Killer, who my manager, he must have gone out a couple of nights during the week and had a few
drinks.
Oh,
that's a real shocker.
And anyway, I knew of this bar just a couple of blocks away and he's like, let's just go there. And I was like, yeah, that's cool, whatever, that's fine. And I remember he went down the street and got some like takeaway pizzas from one of those corner
so
places.
So classy. Just won
like 10
you
pizzas.
You just won like $2 million, but let's go get some $2 pizzas and raise.
And sat at the back of this bar. But it was perfect. Like, it was actually
perfect
great.
For you.
It was perfect. I didn't want to... I actually... Because when we got back to the hotel, we were like, okay, let's try and find a restaurant. We'll do something. And I was like, nah, I don't want a full sit-down formal
I'm
meal.
Not
let's
classy.
It's not about being classy. It was just like... Let's just enjoy and have like a bit of a party.
Yeah, let's pretend we're at home in the backyard.
Yeah.
Having a beer.
So it was
having
good.
Some pizza.
And I went to sleep, I don't know, like 3 or 4 or something and was up at 7 to do all the
media
and
stuff.
Yeah.
How much pressure then, you know, you go back to Australia, you know, we know the sorted having to play in Australia and it's always been your dream to do well there, but it's also difficult because there was so much pressure on you after that, you know. And
well, it's difficult because one, you... playing back in Australia anyway, and I'd always found it hard to play my best there for a multiple different amount of reasons. But then you just won the US Open, the last Grand Slam that anyone remembers watching.
Mm.
So they just think, oh, well,
you're gonna
you should
do it
again.
Yeah.
Like, why wouldn't you?
Yeah,
that's
yeah.
just what you do.
Yeah.
And it's not that simple. Yeah. And actually, that's why this year, watching Naomi go back to back and play well also in Japan only a couple of weeks after the US Open.
Yeah.
Was even probably more impressive because it's not a given
does
that you win one
you...
Grand Slam and then you just go on and win, you know, more.
Yeah. I was going to say, does that make you special? But that kind of makes you sound like shit.
Just facts.
You're impressed by what
she's
done.
By what she did, yeah.
Yeah. The difficulties for you over the last, 3 or 4 years with the singles has been a little bit up and down.
Mm.
And the pressure that you still feel to do well, and you work so hard. You still work as hard as anybody I know, on the court, off the court. And you're a pretty sensitive person. Like, people don't see that about you.
Yeah.
You know, you, like, because you wear the
cry a bit.
Yeah. Well, I will say, I mean, you know, I like to tell these stories because you and I are good friends, and I've been with you through a bunch of random stuff.
Yeah.
And I do remember I was with you in Asia a couple of years ago, and you came off the court in Hong Kong.
Oh, God.
And it was such a hard period of your career because you really were struggling. And I remember you walked off the court in a match that you should have won, you know, against somebody that you should beat. And I remember when you came off the court, and you're usually, it'll be right, I'm okay, you know, I played okay. And you're always looking, you're always somebody that's always spoken in press about, it's fine, I'll be fine. And, you know, some of us are always like, Sam, it's not fine. Just admit it. You know what I mean?
I'm like, I'll bounce back. Yeah, I'll, get, yeah. I'll get it.
Typical Sam. But you know what? Also, when I think about it, bloody hell, good for you to be able to do that as a tennis player. But I remember you came off the court and you sat there and you just cried.
Yeah.
And I think I might have cried with you because I don't think I've ever seen you like that. And you just said, I can't remember the words that you said, but I remember thinking, bloody hell. Like, these are the things that people don't see as all the back stuff.
Mm.
You know, all the days where you cry by yourself.
Yeah.
You've probably done that a lot of times that people don't know about.
For sure.
You know, and you've hidden behind your glasses in matches. And I will tell you a funny story. I was talking to, I think, Andrew Pekovich a couple of weeks ago, and she's like, you know, when Sam has her glasses on, it's so much harder to play her because you just don't know what's going on. You know, but when you see her with the light, sometimes you think, oh, she's a bit worried. And I go, I feel the same way when I played her in doubles. It used to drive me crazy. I'm like, is she pissed? Is she upset? What's going on? You know, so the glasses kind of have helped over the years. But, you know, those are the things that people don't realise, and you've had to dig yourself out of those holes.
Yeah.
How much did it mean to you after, I know, and you know how much I'm protective of you as a friend, but, you know, people on Twitter, and when is Sam going to retire, and this is a joke, and we're losing, and it's an embarrassment. Oh, these are the things that people say.
No, I know.
You know what they say.
No, I've banned a few people.
Yeah, blocked a few people, yeah. Banned a few people. How satisfying was that Australian Open doubles victory for you?
Oh, yeah, that was amazing, because it just kind of, to be back.
Be honest.
No, it was incredible. And
you just wanted to middle finger everybody. Come on.
Well, the great thing was, I actually was a bit surprised how many people really took notice of me winning it. Mm-hmm. And obviously you're in Australia, so it's a bit easy to know. But even the week later, I was up in Sydney walking through Bondi Junction Shopping Centre trying to find some sheets for my bed. And
you can order it on Amazon.
Quite a few people just see me and come up and be like, that was amazing. Oh my God, that was fantastic. Thank you so much for what you do. And, like, we're really proud of me. And I was like, wow, far out. Like,
I won the US Open and nobody knew who I was. Yeah.
But it was really nice, actually. And I think to be home and I didn't have to rush off and go to another event, so I could actually stay home, enjoy it with my family that were there, my friends, and just achieve something that I hadn't achieved for such a long time.
And you preface, years and years before, you and Lisa Raymond had a match point
to
win the Australian Open. Oh, excuse me, two match points to win the Australian Open.
Yeah.
And you didn't win. So I remember Lisa tweeted, way to get the title.
Yeah.
You know, and I randomly gave the trophy out there, which was asked to be at like halfway through the match. Which was funny because I know that you were kind of looking at me in the president's box through the match.
Yeah, because I was like, why would she leave now? That is so bizarre.
Well,
and you asked me for a ticket. So I was like, well, why would she be asking me for a ticket if she's sitting in the pres res?
Well,
and now she leaves?
I was president, like, what? The president, Jane Hodlika, had asked me if I wanted to come and watch in the president's box at the last minute. I thought, well, shit, I don't even need a ticket from Sam. I'm going to get the best seat in the house.
Well, totally.
So I was sitting right behind the court, and you didn't know that. Did you know that? Did I tell
you?
No,
I didn't know that.
And then all of a sudden you looked up and you saw me, which was good because we're mates, and obviously, you know, sometimes it's nice to have a random person in the crowd that you can
look at. It actually really was, because our team were down the other
end. Yeah, down the other end. So you would look at me and I was like, you know, as long as I could be a positive influence on you in some way, nodding my head or good job, Sam. I couldn't really be vocal because I was sitting in the president's box.
Maybe a good thing.
Maybe. Yeah, you're funny. You're fucking funny. Cut two, at some point the career is going to be over.
Yeah.
Have you thought about what you're going to do? Because I think it's one of the most difficult things, and it's not spoken about enough.
Yeah.
Is what are you going to do when you transit? Look, you probably don't have to work ever again in your life. You've got enough money to at least invest
it. No, but you've got to do something. You want to do something.
But have you thought about what you would like to do?
Yeah.
Because I think it's important for your posts. Get retiring, knowing what you kind of want to do afterwards.
Yes, and if there was my coach who I had for a couple of years last year and the year before, Josh Eagle, if there was one thing he really drummed home to me, it was just start thinking about what you want to do after. Yeah. He's like, may not happen for 2 years, 5 years, whatever, however long.
I think it helps you in your career.
Yeah, but he was like, honestly, from himself, his wife was Barbara Shett, who was a player and everything, he's like, I'm telling you, it's harder than you think.
Yeah.
And just start thinking about things and having some ideas and, oh, I might, you know, ask this person this or kind of find out what's going on over there and just start growing a bit of a list of things that you may want to try.
Yeah.
And that I know is important, and I think we've all seen enough tennis players and sports people go from their career and get pretty lost and not know what to do, and it is a really hard transition, which I'm sure is going to be really hard for me as well.
And it has nothing to do with your set monetarily. It's the fact that for your entire life, I know this myself, you are structured. You have an idea every day you wake up what your plan is.
Yeah.
To work out, to play tennis, is to get better.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, boom, that's gone.
Yeah.
And you, most people retire at 65 and 70.
Yeah.
You're retiring at 35, 40.
It's a lot of life.
It's a lot of life left. Yeah. And it, you can.
Well, like I said, I'm very good at following direction. So if I don't have direction, oh my God, what the hell am I going to do?
Yeah. So what are you going to do?
Well.
No, I'm kidding.
No, I mean, I would love to stay in tennis.
Yeah.
It's been my life. I've loved it. There's been some obviously hard moments, but I could not imagine putting down my rackets and not competing and be like, nah, I'm done with it. Don't want anything to do with it.
Don't want to be a triathlete or something like that.
Nah.
Do something like that.
Well, I might do like one of those adventure course things. I think that'd
you
be
do
pretty
like
fun.
That.
I actually love
favorite
hiking
thing to
now.
Do? Favorite thing to do outside of tennis?
Oh, I love going to the beach.
Yeah.
And I've really gotten into hiking, camping.
Uh-huh.
I've done
it
a couple of times.
You don't mind schlepping it in the old 2-man tent?
No, and surprisingly, not showering for 5 days.
Well,
becomes
that doesn't surprise me.
What I have like 4 a day normally.
No, that's true.
So
but you're usually sweating. That's why.
All right, but anyway, yeah, I know that I've got to do. But I would definitely stay in tennis. I know that 100%.
We're going to do little quick questions. Most difficult, like
what that I've ever had.
Yeah, most difficult day that you can remember.
Oh. Probably a day after losing a match that I thought I should win and then questioning, do I want to keep playing because it's really hard?
The French Open?
Oh. Not the French Open, but
just
probably
any.
More recent few years and then struggling with different things. And it's like, oh, do I want to keep putting myself on the line to go through this? Because if I'm not playing, well, I don't have to feel this bad.
Yeah.
But then when you win and you do something great, that's incredible, and you know that that's not going to be easy to achieve either. So I think it's just a... Yeah, there are those little moments where you kind of have that bit of doubt maybe and question, do I want to keep
going,
putting myself out there?
Yeah. And for scrutiny as well, because as I said, you're a sensitive person, so you're probably like, well, what are people saying?
I mean, you know as well, when you're playing, as a tennis player, I think especially because it's an individual sport, so at the end of the day, you're out there and it's on you whether you win, lose, play well, play bad, do whatever. Everyone has an opinion. And whether or not they warrant having an opinion or not, it's okay. It seems okay to, like, scrutinise an athlete.
Yeah, that you don't even know.
That you don't even know. But yet, like, we don't scrutinise someone who, you know, writes a bad article or packs the shopping badly. Or, you know, like...
Packs
the
shopping
badly. I don't know. I'm trying to think of something that you might get angry about.
Yeah, how dare you put a chicken in there with the bananas? It's terrible packing.
No, but, like... things that we're always on the line.
Mm. Yeah.
And we get told what we do really well.
Yeah.
But it's like...
For
just
the people
as much,
who want to be your friends.
Yeah, but just as much like when you mess up a shot or whatever and the whole crowd goes, ugh!
You're like, trust
everyone,
me. You want to stop and go, okay, let me just say something. Guys, I'm really trying, okay? So just, guys.
I mean, that's a natural thing. I do that too when I watch matches, but you know what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
You're always on the line and under the... scrutiny possibly of others and others your coach, because your coach doesn't always tell you what you're doing well.
No,
but I think as a player I've been pretty good at being able to handle those hard conversations with my coaches, people around me, to make me better, because I know
they're being
it's
honest.
Being honest,
they care about
and
you.
I respect that, and they care about me and they only want to see me do better, And I think that has always been part of why I've been able to bounce back, because, all right, they don't want to tell you something bad and see you, you know, tearing up and whatever.
No,
it's not easy.
No, it's pretty hard to
see. I know they're only doing that to make me better, and that's why I think I've been able to constantly think, yep, I can get better and do this.
Other than winning the US Open, because I know that's got to be the highlight of your life and career. Funniest match, funniest thing that happened to you on the court, do you remember anything? Skirt broke, you know.
No, no, no.
Oh, I know one thing that I want to talk about with you, the bloody lip gloss thing. I mean, nobody has lip glossed their lips more than you in a match. You know,
it's
people,
sun protection.
People take a look at Sam every time she plays. Is it every single changeover?
No, no, no. You've cut back.
Oh,
because I'm pretty sure it's not really good for you.
Yeah, probably not. Probably not. Anyway,
depends on the climate we're in. Indian Wells, it comes out a lot more than Miami.
Dubai, yeah. Essentially the desert.
Yeah, the dry places I don't like.
All right, how do you want to finish your career, and what do you want people? And FYI, you should have won the Karen Kransky Award once in your career. I'm just putting that out there, okay? Because I think it's nothing against Petra, who's won it like 38 times.
Share it around,
okay? Petra, put a vote in for Sam, okay? Seriously, because is that the most important thing for you when you finish your career? Is that ultimately in the end, well, what is the most important?
Yeah, I mean, I'd like to be, I guess, remembered as a person who just gave it their best and tried every time they went out of court to play well, be respectful, give it your best. And I've never held a grudge against someone who's beaten me, whether I think they beat me or I beat myself, whatever. It's kind of shake hands and whatever, move on with the next day. And just, yeah, I've been a pretty good player. I've won some amazing events. I've had a great life out of it. But yeah, just someone who tried their best.
Well, I'm putting a vote in for the Karen Kransky Award for this year, and if you don't get it, I'm going to be really pissed. Okay, so everybody out there, okay, vote for Sam for the Karen Kransky. And it's funny because we just watched Ash Barty win here in Miami, and she reminds me so much of you, but you grew up about an hour away from each other. You grew up in the Gold Coast. She grew up in Ipswich.
Ipswich, yeah.
So I think it's also part of that DNA of just being super relaxed, and I think you've brought these young players, someone like, of course, Ash, to believe that she can do what she did today because of what you've done 10 years prior to her and throughout your career. So, and you're good. What people don't realise about you is that you're a great conversationalist, except you don't seem like it because you're quiet.
Yeah, I'm
but when you're
definitely
one-on-one,
quiet.
You are a great conversationalist and, you know, you love the game and you're super...
I can have a lot to say.
Oh, really? God, we could be here for bloody hours. I mean, everyone thinks I'm a chatterbox. I think you're worse than me. Should we go out for your birthday?
Yeah, why not? Let's do it.
Should we have a drink? Oh, no, you got a final tomorrow.
I'll have a drink tomorrow.
I'll have drinks for you. Thanks for coming on the show. Appreciate
thanks,
it.
Bubsy.
All right.
And that's it for this episode of the Racquet Magazine podcast. Thanks for listening. Our host is Renee Stubbs. Our co-host and producer is me, Caitlin Thompson. Music by internationally renowned DJ Stretch Armstrong. Thanks to Tim Rogerian and the team at Acast. Find us at racquetmag.com/podcast and subscribe to us at any of your favorite podcatchers.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.